Well, hey, thanks everybody for coming out this afternoon and braving the extreme heat. And thanks everybody watching online. I met Philip last year, I guess it was a year ago. We did a fun virtual event for his book, Child Alone with Strangers, with our mutual friend, J. Todd Scott. We had such a great time. It was a fun event. And I'm really pleased to welcome Philip back to the Poison Pen, actually for the first time in person, to talk about his wonderful new book, Boys in the Valley. And let me just give him the formal intro that he deserves. Philip Fracassi is the Bram Stoker Award-nominated author of the story collections Behold the Void and Beneath a Pale Sky. His novels include A Child Alone with Strangers, Gothic, and Boys in the Valley. And his stories have been published in numerous magazines and anthologies, including The Best Horror of the Year, Nightmare, Black Static, and Cemetery Dance. Fracassi lives in Los Angeles. Philip, welcome. It's great to have you here.
Hi, is this on?
I think it's working.
Can you guys hear me okay?
Yeah, so everybody watching online, by the way, I could turn it up a little bit. If you have questions, go ahead and send them in. I'll be monitoring that. But I'll also pop up and ask some questions of my own in a little while. So.
All right, cool. All right, so hey guys, thanks so much for coming out. I appreciate it. So yeah, this is my new book, Boys in the Valley. I've been writing horror fiction for almost a decade now, and I have a couple short story collections. I have a couple novels, and this was my first sort of big five novel, so I was very excited about it, my first trade novel. To talk a little bit about the book, Boys in the Valley is about... it's about an orphanage at the turn of the 20th century, so it's 1905, rural Pennsylvania. This small orphanage in the middle of nowhere that's run by a handful of priests, and there's 30 boys who live there, and they kind of have a rough life. Again, it's 1905. They're all, you know, they're not in a city, so they have to like farm for their food. They have to, you know, do chores. They work hard. Discipline is a big thing, and they all come from these kind of horrible backgrounds. So they're kind of these poor lost souls in a way. And then one stormy night, this is not a spoiler, it's on the back of the book, there's a knocking on the orphanage door, and the priest opened the door, and there is the sheriff from the next town over, which is a few hours away by horse, has got this man with him, and the man is horribly scarred and injured, and they're hoping that the priest can save his life. And when the priest realizes that the man is not only horribly injured, but he also happens to have some pretty dark occult symbols carved into his skin, they it won't spoil the situation, but he has a sort of a sinister presence about him. And when the man dies, whatever evil was inside of him sort of permeates the orphanage and the boys who live there. And it turns into a sort of, I don't want to say good versus evil, but affected versus not affected. And the rest of the book is basically about how these boys all survive when the orphanage gets snowed in and they're stuck together, and sort of chaos and horror ensue. But the book so far has been done, has been getting amazing reviews. Stephen King tweeted about it, which was, as you can imagine, very nice, and called it old school horror and told everyone to go buy it. And Nightfire has been a great publisher to work for so far. And sales have been great. We're almost through the first print run already, which is amazing for me. Coming from the indie horror world, this is kind of a whole new thing for me, so it's very exciting. And what I thought I would do is I would just read the opening of the book for you, and then maybe we can do some questions and stuff like that. And before I start, does anyone have any questions? You guys want to ask anything before I read the opening? Okay, cool. I apologize. I'm going to look sort of down, but I've got the microphone, so I'm going to try and... So this is the prologue. I would read something further down in the book, but frankly, anything I think I read would give away something. So I always like just to read from the from the opening on. So this is the prologue. Harris Valley, Pennsylvania, 1898, midnight. The muted thunder of wagon wheels wakes me from shallow sleep. Outside my darkened window, the clop and hard breath of horses. A rattling wagon pulls close to the house, then slows, then stops. Men's raised voices group together, then fall apart. Disappointment veiled by revelry and drink. I hear mother in the kitchen dividing my attention. I throw off the blanket and run barefoot to the window. Cold air pushes through thin glass, and I shiver. Father's inky silhouette stands in the narrow lane, one arm raised. He cries out, and now distant voices reply. His arm drops to the side. He turns toward the house and appears to stumble, then catch himself. The long black line of the rifle cradled in his arms points skyward. Pots clatter from the kitchen, and I run to the door that separates my room from the living area. This includes a sitting space, a dining area, and kitchen. Our whole world is but three rooms and a pair of outhouses. A world held together by warped wooden planks and warmed by a rusted black stove that eats coal faster than we can fill it. I'm lucky to have my own room, even if it's small. Though I'm little, I'm not able to take three large steps in any direction. Father says I'm a runt, but mother says a 9-year-old boy has room to grow. I hope to get big, but not so big I can't fit in my room. I like it too much. I see more clearly now because mother has lit the kitchen lanterns. There's enough space between my bedroom door and the frame to stick a finger. So light comes through easy, coats the dark walls, and disrupts the shadows in the corners and beneath my bed. I step softly to the door. It wouldn't do for them to know I'm up, and put an eye to the gap. If I swivel my head, I can see the entire kitchen and the dining table, but not much else. I'm cold and nothing but long johns, but want to hear about the trip. Mother has the stove going, and I smell the warming onion soup she'd taken from the icebox. She puts on a kettle for coffee. Father slams the door, and the house rattles. Mother wipes her hands on her apron in a way she does when she's upset, like she's wringing it dry. Father enters my field of vision, all beard and worn leather, a beat-to-hell Stetson wedged over black hair. He pulls out a chair, sits heavily, the rifle butt clunks against the floor, and he looks at the old Winchester as if willing it to speak. Nothing, Mother says. Nothing at all? Father waits for the gun to answer, but it stays silent. I'll have what's in that pot, sissy, and some coffee. It's heating, she says, stirring. She keeps her eye on the stove and off my father. You've been drinking. I inspect him more closely for signs of drunkenness, wondering what my mother sees that makes it apparent, but nothing stands out. He looks tired and wronged, but that's his natural state.
Sheriff is shooting poachers. Land's dry.
Father shakes his head. He takes off the Stetson, sets it on the table. He still holds the rifle. I want to open the door and go to him, sit with him, and talk like men about the sheriff and the land. The kettle starts to whistle.
What are we going to do, Jack? The garden can provide some, but we need meat. Winter's coming.
Father runs a hand through his long hair.
Please, he says, and I tremble at his voice as well as the cold. Shut up, sissy. Just shut up and bring me some coffee.
I will my mother to stop, to leave him be. She knows what he's like. I close my eyes for a moment and silently pray. Then I watch. The kettle is screaming, and I know if I hadn't been awake already, I would be now. The house is filled with the high-pitched shriek of rushing steam. I see, Mother says. You go out with the boys for 2 days, drinking and who knows what else. Leave me and Peter here to starve. To starve! She screams this last at him, and I see my father's face redden. His eyes close tight, then open wide.
Shut your goddamn mouth, he yells, spit flying in the lantern light like mist. Shut it, Shut it. You're horrible, Jack. You'll wake Peter. Father slams his hand on the table, and Mother, realizing she's gone too far, pushed him too hard, quickly removes the kettle and pours coffee into a cup next to the stove. The reprieve of the kettle's whistle is luxurious. You're a disappointment, she says as she pours. How dare you swear in my house? Use the Lord's name in vain. He mumbles something. It sounds like that's enough, but I'm not certain of the words. I just know he's upset. I've never seen him in such a state. His downcast face is stone, his eyes black pearls. Mother brings the coffee cup to the table, lips tight as a pulled drawstring. You are no husband, she says. You aren't even a man. He turns to retort just as she arrives with the cup. His elbow knocks it from her hand, and the hot coffee drops into his lap. Father screams in pain, leaps up. The chair clatters to the floor, and Mother backs away, hands raised in supplication. Apologies and terror spill from her mouth. Enough, he says. I watch his father, with a practiced and casual movement, raises the barrel of the rifle and cocks the lever with a hideous smoothness. Mother holds up her hands. Oh, Lord Jesus! The eruption of the gun shatters the air. Mother jerks backward as if tugged by the hand of God. She hits the stove with such force that the door pops open and coals fly out in a shower of sparks like burning souls. A lantern on a nearby hook crashes to the ground and fiery oil splatters the floor and wall. Frail curtains catch the hot spray and burn. There's a moment where time stands still, and then Father is howling. Oh, sissy! He puts a dirty hand over his mouth as the room brightens. Oh, damn it, sissy! He kneels beside her and sobs. Wet heat runs down my leg, and I look down to see a puddle forming around my foot. When I raise my eyes, Father is once more seating himself at the table. One wall crawls with flame. Dark smoke rides the low ceiling like storm clouds. Father turns his head toward my door, and for a moment, our eyes meet. I imagine how I must look to him, a sliver of sun, a bright probing eye in the dark, watching his sins. Father holds his eyes on me. I make a study of him. Wet eyes and must hair, straggled beard, a sweat-sheened face smeared in prancing red flames. He looks away, back to my mother. He doesn't turn toward me again. I want to cry out, to scream, to run to him. My teeth chatter. I begin to moan, and I can't stop. I can't move. I can't breathe. All I can do is watch. He slowly cocks the lever of the Winchester, the very one he taught me to shoot with that past summer, puts the grip between his knees and the barrel's lusterless tip beneath his chin. Something inside me comes awake, and at the last second I shut my eyes. This shot is duller than the first. Breathing fast and heavy, I pull open the door and stare boldly at the scene. For a moment, I see myself as a spectator, a thin shadow shaking before a fiery dragon, crotch-stained and whimpering. Before me is nothing but death and blood and smoke and flame. My whole world is fire. And then I think I'll just read this very short first chapter, too. It gives you like a little introduction to the orphanage. So this is now, I think, 6 years later, chapter one, St. Vincent's Orphanage, Delaware County, Pennsylvania, 1905. Peter, wake up. I open my eyes to the familiar, white walls, two rows of metal-framed beds, bleached pine floor, bright pale light bursting from large uncovered windows that line the east-facing wall. Two large arched oak doors at the far end of the long room are closed, the winking glimmer of the polished iron cross that hangs above them, a constant sentinel, always watching. Simon pokes me in the shoulder. Wake up, you're having a nightmare. I sit up and rub my eyes. Most of the kids are still asleep, so it must be early, not yet six. I'm up, I say, and shove Simon gently back toward his cot. He laughs and sits down on his mattress, looking out the large window between our beds. Might snow today, he says excitedly, as if that's a good thing. Too soon, I yawn and stretch. It's icy cold in the dorm. My thin robe is balled up at my feet, and I pull it on over my wool pajamas, which I've long grown out of, annoyingly exposing my ankles and wrists. I slip my feet into shoes and follow Simon's stare through the glass. The sky outside is white as bone and just as hard. I stand up to get a better look at the grounds. The surrounding trees are leafless and gray. They look dead and withered. The earth is a wealth of weedy grass that in the dim light looks as gray as the trees. Colorless. The barn that holds our horses, sheep, and goats sits to the south. Ahead is the field. We'll be working that morning, pulling what we can from the earth and storing it for the winter, which I've heard will be long and harsh. I wonder if any of the boys will die before spring shows its face again and say a silent prayer for all of them. I glance at the metal wind-up clock in my dresser, the only furniture we're allowed, and see it's a few minutes before six. I'm the only one who has a personal clock, and it's the only thing I have left from my childhood, my prior life. The only thing I saved when I fled the burning house. I push in the knob on the clock's alarm, disabling it. No need to hear the shrill bell to wake me. My memories serve well enough to break my sleep. Go wash, Simon, and take Basil with you. Basil, a small, sickly, black-haired English boy, not even 10 years old, watches me and Simon from across the room with wide owl eyes. He's already fully dressed. Aw, why, Peter? Because he's up and ready. I watch them as they trudge out the dorm toward the washroom. I study the others in the early morning light, curious if anyone else has woken. It seems my nightmare didn't disturb the others, and I feel badly for rousing Simon. But it's near dawn now, and Poole will be ringing first bell shortly, expecting us to be dressed and ready before the subsequent bell 10 minutes after. I shed my robe and pajamas, begin pulling on the heavy shirt and pants folded neatly inside my dresser. It will be cold today, and the idea of winter's arrival worries me for reasons I don't fully understand. I've been through many winters here at St. Vincent's, and they're all the same, a seemingly eternal purgatory of cold and dark. And yet, as I look through the window at the dreary landscape, I find myself frowning with worry. My melancholy breaks when the first bell brays its command from the foyer. I turn to the room and see the lumps beneath the sheets begin to stir and groan. The boys are waking. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, let's just talk a little bit about...
poor Peter.
Yeah, poor Peter. Well, I wanted to kind of get in, maybe have you tell us a little bit about the full cast and crew of the novel. I mean, there's some really great, I mean, kids but just to kind of start off... The horror genre is really undergoing a nice renaissance at the moment, you know, a resurgence. And, you know, can you talk a little bit about that? It seems like there's this nice infusion of other, maybe influences of other genres, you know, the literary genre, the noir genre, you know, people like Stephen Graham Jones wrote a nice blurb on the front. Mm-hmm. Any thoughts on that?
Yeah, so being a horror writer, you know, I've been writing my whole life. I've written a lot of what we call literary fiction. I try not to say literary fiction when I'm around other writers because they all kind of look at me like I'm an idiot. But non-genre fiction. But then I wrote my first horror story in 2015, immediately sold it after decades of trying to sell work. Wrote another horror story, immediately sold it, and I'm off and running. And I have, you know, I've just been kind of going on stuff ever since then. So I think to Patrick's point, like, yeah, right now horror seems, and I don't know if it's because of self-publishing or if it's because people are becoming more accepting of the horror genre. But one thing about the horror genre that I think has definitely happened since 2015 specifically is it's really expanded, like in tone and in the types of stories and the quality of the literature that's out there now. Because when, you know, it's not, I think people think horror and they think about zombies and they think about aliens or whatever. They think about what they see on late night TV.
Slasher stuff.
Slashers, exactly. Friday the 13th type stuff. And that's really like just one small sliver of horror now. I think, you know, I think guys like Paul Tremblay, Victor Laval, you know, even Katrina Ward, who's, you know, those guys, Josh Malerman. I mean, there are so many, and there's new voices coming out now. There's a diversity of voices. You know, I went from like Eric LaRocca, and I just, who's really coming on the scene hard now and taking very, you know, traditional dark
you know, I would say body horror kind of stuff into the mainstream. But yeah, there's, I always tell people that horror is such a huge sandbox, and there's, and it, you know, you could take science fiction and you could take fantasy and you could take crime, and you could, you know, you could find a lot of those books would fit into a horror section as well. My book, A Child Alone with Strangers, is half, you know, a crime horror hybrid. My next book is a science fiction novel with like horror elements. So, you know, I feel like there's, I feel like as writers, we're today, in my opinion, we're less worried about category and more worried about telling a great story. And I think what horror does that some of the other genres don't do is it allows you to kind of expand into any direction you want to expand into. Stephen King was the first one to really do that. When you read a Stephen King book, you never really know what's going to happen. Like, it could be very traditional story, you know, built in realism, or there could be a giant cosmic spider at the end. Like, you don't really know what's going to happen. So, you know, you open the closet, there could be a monster in there, or there could be a portal to another dimension. And I think that's what's so fun about writing horror is there are no rules. So, but yeah, I think there is just such a wide range of diverse voices and in today's horror, writing horror today, than there were maybe 20 or 30 or 40 years ago, that I think people are beginning to find voices that they like, that they connect with, and then through that gateway, finding more horror that they enjoy.
And it seems like that there's a lot of, you know, there's an infusion of folklore a lot more into stories, maybe. You know, when you were just reading that passage, kind of describing the scene, I read this book in black and white. You know, when I was reading it, it seemed, the scene seemed black and white. And it, I'm like, this is kind of Dickensian, very Dickensian. And, you know, these poor kids, you know.
Yeah, I don't think I use any colors at all in this book. I mean, I think the only time I think I use colors is when Peter visits a girl on a nearby farm.
Yes,
and he's sweet on her.
Grace.
And I just, and it's kind of like the love story version part of the book. And I describe her, her house and her world very in a lot of colors. But I think for the most part, when I'm talking about the orphanage, everything is grays and blacks and whites. Yeah,
right.
It's funny that you caught that. Yeah.
And don't you find that horror, you know, kind of taps into a lot of these sort of archetypes, you know, these sort of fears that we all share, you know, horror really goes into the shadow side, you know. I remember we had a Leslie Klinger here, and we were talking about Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde,
yeah,
you know, his annotated version of it. And, you know, a lot of what you're talking about in this book, it seems to me, could be read on, this is one half of our own self, you know, that we keep hidden. Then as a reader, we always bring ourselves into reading the book. But so it's maybe more about me than about your book. But
no, not at all. No, one thing about me as a writer and all my books and stories is I'm very much that my characters are very authentic. They're human. They're gray. They have dark sides. They have light sides. They do good things. They do bad things. They make smart decisions. They make dumb decisions. And also they're very conflicted. In this book, especially, as well as in a couple of my other books, but really in this book, so many of the characters are conflicted. They, you know, Peter, the main character, is he's sort of like he's being groomed to be a priest, and he's like this father figure who's a priest who is sort of helping him along that path. But at the same time, he's kind of pulled different directions, and he's very conflicted about what his future holds. And then as the story progresses and things kind of ramp up on the horror side, he kind of finds himself having to make some very difficult decisions, and all of his prior life decisions kind of come into play as to what he decides to do moving forward. The secondary character, David, another one of the boys, is very conflicted because he's trying to do the right thing, but at the same time, he hates the orphanage. He hates the priest so much, and they're such... you know, they can be so strict, and he's had a really bad upbringing, a really tough upbringing. So he's really conflicted about what the right decision is and who to help and who to side with, because there's a lot of this is about choosing sides in the book. And And even the priests are conflicted. So I, in all my stories, and sometimes this kind of bites me a little bit with readers, well, they'll be like, I didn't really like that character. And you're, you know, supposed to be the hero. And to your point about archetypes, I don't care about archetypes at all. I'm about creating very real people and watching what they do in different situations and kind of like, you know, it is what it is. And, you know, the heroes don't always make good decisions, and the villains sometimes will surprise you. So that's kind of the way I write.
Right. Johnson is a good example of that.
Yeah. Yeah. Brother Johnson's a character in this who has a very colorful arc. And yeah, same thing, is that it's just it's decisions. And one of the things I was talking about recently with a friend, you know, they were asking me about the religious overtones of the book and then about the evil that permeates the orphanage. And I told her, I said, I want to make it very clear that at no point do any of the children or really the characters in this book, are they, you know, making decisions, are they being forced into any decisions? This is not an exorcist story where there's a little girl who's, you know, got bad teeth and spewing vomit, and you don't, and she's just kind of, she's being controlled by some sort of sinister force. These kids all know what they're doing, and they do some really bad stuff. So, many of them, and some of them do really great stuff, really good stuff. So, but at no point is it taken out of their control, which I think is an interesting, for me, it's sort of my take on the possession, trope. It's not really full possession. It's really just more like an infection, if you will, that almost, exacerbates what they're already feeling and almost like a reveal of their true characters amplified, you know, taken to 11. And that's where things get really violent.
Yes, indeed.
Yeah.
Yeah. Now that's very interesting, because it is a variation on a theme that you don't see very often, you know? So just to kind of reiterate, our main character is Peter Barlow, and he arrives at this orphanage after watching both of his parents die in front of him.
Yeah, you guys all heard that already.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. And tell us about like some of the other guys, like Bartholomew.
Oh, yeah, right. So, yeah, so it's a wide cast of characters. So there's 30 kids at this orphanage, and all of them are in the book. And there's like 5 priests, I think. And everyone gets their screen time, as it were. The book is also... I'm going to come back. I'm going to get there. The book is also told in different POV. So, for example, Peter's perspective is told in first person, which, because I really want Peter to be the reader's guide. So he's very much, I did this and I did that. And then everyone else is sort of third person, but it's told through like David and Peter and Brother Johnson. And those are the guys who you're kind of learning about what's happening through their eyes. So, but all 30 kids, you know, are realized in the book. And when I was writing the book, I realized that I had to figure out a tiering system, because there are kids like Bartholomew and Peter and David and Basil and like the twins who I needed the reader to really connect with. But I only had, you know, it's a pretty slim book. It reads pretty fast. So I didn't want to spend a lot of time going into too much detail, but I wanted to get just enough so that the reader felt connected to them. And when I brought them up again, or when they re-entered the stage, as it were, you recognized them and you knew who they were and you felt something about them. So that was an interesting process for me, and I really enjoyed it. But I ended up trying to get them. So there's some kids where you kind of know who they are, and then there's some kids you know who they are, and you connect with them to some degree. And then there's that kind of top tier of main characters where like you're really, that's who you're identifying with throughout the story. And in addition, Brother Johnson, Father Andrew, who is sort of like the father figure for Peter, Father Poole, who's sort of this very strict headmaster kind of role, and who does, you know, his way of punishing the children is barbaric, and it's, you know, you understand probably why some of the kids do what they do later on in the book. Even I was talking to, I had the chance to speak with David Aaron Baker, who narrated the book, for the audiobook, and he does all of Dean Koontz's books. He did a Steinbeck book. He does Jonathan Lethem books. So he's like a top tier narrator. I was so excited that we got him, and he and I had a good chat about like, I've got to figure out a way to, you know, voice all these different characters, and I want to make sure that I get them distinctive to a degree. So it was very interesting for him as well to go through that process of trying to figure out how to give each of the boys a unique voice to a degree. So it's a fun cast of characters. It's a lot of characters for a very short book, but based on everything I've been hearing so far, I think it worked.
Absolutely. It seems like there's some similarities between the creepy orphanage and the sanitarium. You know, that they have some shared lineage there.
Yeah.
Can you talk about the importance of the building itself? It seems like that it's quite important.
Yeah. So this orphanage is actually, this setting is not made up. I was researching a screenplay for a completely different story, and I came across this article, and it was about a boys' orphanage in rural Pennsylvania at the turn of the century, and a bunch of boys disappeared mysteriously from the orphanage, like a lot of them. and during like wellness checks or whatever, whoever that worked during those days, they realized after, you know, whoever was checking on such things, you know, came back after a year of being away and realized that like half the boys were gone. And in those days, a lot of orphans got sold to factories and child labor situations, and a lot of them died. Like Peter mentioned, like you'd lose a couple over the winter because there wasn't enough food and there wasn't enough medicine or whatever it was, and it was cold and they didn't have proper clothing and that kind of thing. But there was such a large number of the boys that vanished, and so the orphanage was shut down and the priests were investigated and became this big scandal at the time. So this is actually based on... or at least the acorn of the story is based on that article that I read, and the orphanage itself is in my story, not in real life, was a failed church, basically a failed. They had built this church in the middle of nowhere, thinking it was going to be part of a town that never came to fruition, and so the church hierarchy said, well, we need to turn a profit on this structure that we built, so they add a second floor and they made it into an orphanage. So that's how my building came into being. But it is very remote. It is only accessible by horse-drawn cart, and the nearest major city is like, I think, a 3-hour cart ride. And one of the ways the kids get food, besides growing it themselves and all that kind of thing, in the fields and the animals and they have at the orphanage, is they have to go. There's like a farm that they travel to about an hour away, and they travel, and the farmer, you know, they give them like the fresh eggs and the dairy and whatever they can't get from their own, dirty hands.
The hill farm.
And that's where Peter meets Grace, who's a young girl, and it's his only, aside from the orphans he lives with, it's the only person, other kid he's ever met, and so she has a very serious impact on him, and just like the way she lives, and she's very alive, and like I said, her world is very colorful, and so it's an intense contrast for him, and at the same time he's being told that he's going to be a priest and he can never get married or whatever, so he's having a lot of, Peter's going through a lot of stuff. It's been called a coming of age story, which I don't disagree with. I think you could call it a coming of age story for multiple characters in the
well, yeah. I mean, she kind of guides his development in various ways. You know, she starts loaning him books,
right?
Starting with Alice in Wonderland, which is a good entree.
Yeah, and I think I'm trying to remember the other one. Alice and Wizard of Oz. He gets Wizard of Oz from her too, and they start. I don't want to give too much away, but they start trading letters secretly. And sort of his like secret that he keeps from all the other boys, because he's the one who gets to go to the hill farm with Father Andrew and see Grace. So it's very sweet.
But then you say that the other boys, yeah, we've all read those letters. They're boring.
Yeah, right.
All the other kids steal in when he's gone and read the
letters. He thinks he's being sneaky when he's not really being. It's hard to be sneaky when you all live in the same, when 30 kids live in the same room. Yeah.
Right.
But to your point about the setting, I think what makes it, aside from the remoteness of the structure, is is that there's the orphanage is exactly what I just said, is all the boys live together. So they live in this one sort of dorm room, and they all wash together in this giant washroom, and there's one dining hall. And so everything is very group oriented, which becomes kind of savage when half of the boys become, you know, well, for lack of a better word, we'll put possessed or overtaken by this evil that infects the orphanage. So, because it's not like there's any place to go, there's no secret, there's no, you know, you can't go to your room and lock the door. You know, it's all, everything's kind of like open. So that becomes a big issue as they're trying to figure out how to survive.
When the evil is unleashed on this group of kids and the priests too, by the way.
Yeah.
I'm just curious about different drafts. Did you kind of know what you were doing through the whole way, or did you sort of plot it out? All right, you know what? Maybe I'll tease the reader and think that this one isn't part of this group.
Well, I don't want to give anything away.
No.
Well, I'll answer that indirectly because I don't want to give anything away. But I will say that I do. Okay, so normal, my writing, very quickly, my writing process is that once I have a one or two page, vomit of what I want to do with a book, like it's pretty much like this happens. The next thing I do is I go to like a very extensive outline. I create like a 55 to 65 point outline in a program called Scrivener. And then I begin writing based on that outline. So with this book, which is unusual, I want to state that ahead of time, I did do the outline and all that stuff. That took me a few weeks. I wrote the book itself in 4 weeks. I pretty much was at my desk 10 to 12 hours a day every day straight for 30 days. I was so excited to write the book, and it was coming out of me so fast that I didn't even want to I never really wanted to stop and go to bed. And I was writing between like 5 and 10,000 words a day. So it was very intense. I knew the whole story came to me pretty much at once. I didn't really have that. I think that's why I was writing it so fast. I didn't really have a lot of, I knew pretty much what was going to happen to each character. I knew their outcomes already. I knew who was going to do what. It all kind of hit me at once. There was a few of the set pieces that I had to kind of figure out. Set pieces meaning, like how to figure out a certain action sequence or whatever. But yeah, for the most part, I had the whole thing kind of hit me, which doesn't always happen. But in this one, I kind of had the whole thing hit me at once. Yeah. So I just kind of went pretty. It came to me in one big lump, and I just kind of like knocked it out and very quickly. Usually it takes me about 6 to 8 weeks to write a draft, first draft. And this one I knocked out in less than 4 weeks. Yeah.
Wow. Is there significance to the name Paul Baker?
Not that I know of.
He's our he's our guy that's sort of
he's the one who comes to
the demon.
Yeah, he's the one who comes to the orphanage in the middle of the night.
All kinds of messed up.
No, I don't think so. I think it was just I tend to overuse Peter in a lot of my stories and books, and so after this book, I had to kind of make sure I stopped doing that because it's my middle name. So I, for whatever reason, I kind of was like I always end up throwing it in there. But no, Paul Baker was just no. I think that was just a name I came up with. For the most part, they were all just made up names I thought sounded good. Or also, again, with 30 characters plus 5 priests, you want to be distinctive, but not like, you know, distinctive to the point where you're distracting the reader. So I just wanted to make sure that they all had names that were memorable, but not like sticky. It's like when you're fantasy books and you're like Sojavanin or whatever, you don't know how to pronounce it because it's got too many consonants. So yeah, I tried to keep it somewhat simple.
Or if you're reading the Russians, you know, reading.
right. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, before we open up to questions, I know we may have some aspiring writers in the group. When did you start writing? Have you always been a writer?
So I've been writing since I was in third grade, and I've always wanted to be an author. I've never strayed from that path. I was one of those kids that was reading Stephen King when I was 14 and 15, and would see his picture on the back of the book and be like, oh man, one day I want to have my picture on the back of a book like that and be an author. And so I've always written, like I said earlier, I just didn't really know what I was, I think I was searching for my voice in a way, and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. So I, like I said, I was writing a lot of kind of, I would say dark fiction, but not genre, and couldn't really sell anything. And, and then around 2010, I started writing screenplays. So, and I was having some success with that. I wrote like 6 or 7 screenplays for Disney. I wrote a screenplay for Lifetime Television called A Girl Missing, which you can get on demand. My Disney movie you can get on demand is Santa Paws 2, The Santa Pups. If you ever see that one, it's a, if you have a 5-year-old, they're going to love it. And so I wrote, and I started writing horror screenplays because that was really what I read, but I wasn't writing horror fiction. And so it was just like this weird confluence of like life and writing and building up my tools and all that kind of stuff. And it was kind of late in life for most writers, but, I think I was in my mid 40s when I finally said, I'm just going to try writing horror and see what happens. And yeah, like I said, it's just taken off since then. And I feel like now I have, my niche, but at the same time, it's given me that I've learned so much over the last, 7 or 8 years of writing and publishing. I've learned so much about writing that now I'm beginning to expand into other stuff. So my next, novel, which I can't announce yet, unfortunately, but I did just sign my deal today, so I'm very excited about it. Is a science fiction thriller, so that hopefully will be out next summer. And then I have another horror novel with these guys in 2025. But I'm beginning to expand the different genres. I wrote a book that's on an indie press called Don't Let Them Get You Down. That is about anxiety and depression. So I'm finding now. I guess it's a confidence thing, but it's also just like, it's just, learning how to be a writer and learning how to write, and publishable fiction. So now I'm kind of like expanding into all sorts of different stuff, but horror is sort of my go-to because, like I said earlier, I love the sandbox. I love not having any restrictions. I love being able to have the story go wherever I want it to go. Yeah.
Anybody have any questions?
Hey, man. Big fan. Oh, thank you.
I'm assuming when you started writing, you started with short fiction versus novels. Is that correct?
Yeah, definitely started writing short fiction. I wrote 3 literary novels. Again, that word, non-genre novels, when I was like in my 30s. One of those was Don't Let Them Get You Down. The other two probably, one's called The Egotist. And why the other one won't ever be in print, but then when I started writing horror fiction, yeah, I started writing short stories. So I wrote a short story called Mother, and I had a friend of I was at the time in communication with an author named Laird Barron, who is an amazing writer, yeah, who everybody should read, and he kind of like mentored me a little bit, but he was basically like, he basically read that story and said, you need to keep writing horror fiction. This is like very good. And so I just basically for, I would say like 3 years, all I did was write short fiction because I wanted to get my name out there. I wanted to get published. I wanted to kind of start building a resume, if you will, a readership to a degree. And also when you go out with a novel to an agent, or a publisher, if you can say I've been published in these places, it eases that a little bit. It gives you a little bit more credibility. Ultimately it comes down to what you've written, but it does help get you in the door. So I kind of was really focused on short fiction and I never really thought I would be in a position to be doing what I'm doing right now, which is talking to you guys with Macmillan book. But then I had an agent and he said, my first of three agents, who said, you can keep writing short fiction and have a lot of fun with it and make writing can be a great hobby, or you can start writing novels and make a career out of it. And so that was when I started trying that's when I tried my first horror novel. That was like around 2018, I think, 2017, 2018. So, and now I do both. So I write probably 1 or 2 horror novels a year, and then I write like another 5 to 6 to 7 stories depending on how long the novels take. And I'm still writing screenplays. So I've written, I think, so usually I have to get a screenplay in there somewhere. But yeah, so, but I definitely start, I definitely tell people to start with short fiction and then try and get published a few places. Even if it's small website or a small magazine or local, whatever. And then when you have a novel that you really feels like something you feel good about and you take it and want to submit it to agents, or to independent presses, you can say, I've been published in these places, and you kind of have a little bit of a more of a calling card, if that makes sense. Yeah. That's for me, that it worked. And I'll tell you something else. When I published my first story, I published it with a very small press, and I was not paid a lot of money. We'll call it no money. And a lot of people kind of came at me about that in the horror world. And it was really surprising to me because I didn't really know any of these people, and they were kind of, there's a lot of, you know how social media gets, but, and there was kind of all this like blowback on this publisher and on the authors who he was publishing, meaning me, and about, because like, oh well, you're not taking pro rates, you're hurting everybody, and by publishing your stuff without doing pro rates. I'm like, look, man, I spent a decade in the music industry, and the way bands get their names out there is they make these little demo tapes and they take them to clubs and they hand them out, or they sell them for a buck or whatever it is, or they give them to record people and people listen to the tape. And that's kind of, it's called grassroots marketing. And it's, that's where you get your stuff out there. And I'm like, look, I just want to get my stuff out there. And it worked because people started reading it, and it got me more deals, and it got me a short story collection book deal. And so while I appreciate that you always want to try and get professional rates or semi-pro rates, if you can try those avenues first. But if Fantasy and Science Fiction magazine turns you down, and all these other magazines turn you down, and you still have this story, you know, I'd say get it out there, get it read, you know. And one last thing, I'm sorry, but since we're talking about it for writers, is one story I always like to tell writers, because it's a very frustrating business and can be very difficult and it can be very trying, is I had a short story that was rejected by I think it was something like 16 magazines and websites, anthologies. Nobody wanted this story, but I loved the story, and so when I got an offer to do a book, a story collection, I put that story in the book. That story was called Failsafe, and it was reprinted in Best Horror of the Year. It's been since been reprinted in Nightmare Magazine. I think three other different publications have all reprinted. It's been printed in German and Italian, and it's being made into a major studio bought it for film. So just to show you, you always got to persevere. You got to just keep going, and you can't let people tell you what's good or what's bad or what works or doesn't work, because not everyone's going to connect with your voice. So the idea is just to keep believing in yourself and keep going, and eventually you'll find a readership. Yeah.
How long did it take you before you felt like, okay, this is me, this is my voice? Did you start out, you know, I think everybody does, probably by, you know, imitating your favorite writers and a little bit of this, a little bit of that?
I never did pastiche. I wasn't big on that. The thing about me, is I'm still, I don't want to say I'm still trying. I wouldn't say I'm still finding my voice, but I like to experiment with voice. So all of my books sort of read, they're sort of uniquely told. I let the story dictate how I tell it. I don't force the story into my tone. So especially with my short work, a lot of my short fiction varies wildly as to the prose, as to how I tell it. Some stuff's very pulpy, some stuff is, you know, hard science, some stuff is more literary, some stuff is more, you know, slasher or gory, whatever you want to call it, body horror. And my novels are kind of the same way. I get a lot of reviews where readers will be like, I can't believe this book was written by the same guy as this other book that he wrote. Like I have a book called Gothic that's very, very different in tone and telling than this book. And this book, Child Known Strangers, is I think in a lot of ways very different, told a very different way than Boys in the Valley. So I really like playing with different voices. I like telling stories different ways. But that said, to answer your question directly, I would say that I think when I say finding your voice, it's almost like it's in a way, it's kind of like saying finding your confidence. And I think I found my confidence probably right around the time I sold this book because I had already sold this one and I had sold a couple short story collections and I'd been nominated for a Stoker Award and stuff like that. But I think I felt like, okay, now I've kind of hit, now I feel like I can just sit down and I can, the idea of writing a novel isn't scary. It's exciting. And it's not a question of, can I do it? It's a question of, how am I going to do it? And who's going to, you know, are people going to like it, obviously. But I think I would say right around, so I wrote this novel in 2021. So it took me about 7 or 8 years, I guess, before I was feeling really confident enough in myself to be like, I can sit down and tell a story however I want to tell it. Yeah,
it is really interesting the way you tell this story because, you know, Peter is our first person. He's kind of our everyman in a way. But then it's also, so he's telling the story, but so is kind of David in a way. And so is Johnson in a way. They're at a third person, slightly removed perspective, but it's still a really interesting mix of voices.
Yeah, and the thing with the reason I did Peter in first person is because I really wanted Peter to be the one who took the reader's hand and guided them through the story. And I wanted to, I don't necessarily think this is going to be a neg- I don't mean to, this might sound strange. I don't necessarily think Peter's the most interesting character in the book, but he is the one I think readers will connect with the most, and he is the hero, if you will. And so I think, I wanted the reader to feel real connection to him so that when you were reading his chapters and it was in first person, you were kind of feeling like it was you inside the story, the reader inside the story, and these things were happening to you. So that as the story progresses, and I will not spoil anything, that becomes, that really, you know, meld you into the emotions of the story. More and more into the visceral physicality of the story. And one of the things I work very hard at is when even my short work, is I work very hard at getting readers involved emotionally. Some people don't like that. They feel like it's too slow, too much of a slow burn, but I really, with some of my stuff, but I really like to get readers connecting with the characters first. And then, when the bad stuff happens, you feel it hits you a lot harder, is the idea and the hope.
Anybody have any thoughts, questions? Come on, yes you do, I can tell. You get something percolating in there. No? Putting her on the spot.
Yeah. Yeah. Thunderstorm, give me a break. I'm just kidding.
I know, right?
I love working with indie presses, and I will always work with indie presses. You know, one of my good friends is a guy named Josh Mellerman, who wrote a little book called Bird Box that you probably haven't heard of. But that was a joke. Everyone knows the Bird Box is, right? Okay, good. Okay.
Well, Andy Davidson too wrote nice.
Andy's a good friend. Yeah. And Andy just is doing some indie stuff now. But Josh is similar to me. He really likes taking some stuff and doing it in the indie world or with the limited deluxe press. And then also having like his Del Rey stuff. But so I have, yeah. So I've got, I have a book coming out from Lethe Press, who is my publisher for my short fiction. So I'm doing a new book of short fiction called No One Is Safe. That's coming out, in this October, November. I don't know the exact date yet. And then, which I'm very excited about, which is 14 stories. That's really pulpy, horror, fun, sci-fi, kind of just batshit crazy stuff. And then I have I'm going to have a novel, hopefully next summer. I'm waiting to confirm that, which is going to be like sci-fi thriller. And then I'll have another horror novel in 2025. And on the indie press, yeah, I'm working with Thunderstorm still. We have a couple things in the works. I'm working with Earthling still. We have a couple things in the works.
Cemetery Dance?
I don't have anything with Cemetery Dance currently, although we've been talking about doing a sequel to Gothic, which would be through their trade paperback line. And ebooks, but the problem with Cemetery Dance is I don't know how much they're doing in the limited space anymore. I think it's pretty few and far between. I think Richard Chismar, who's head of Cemetery Dance, has become a very successful writer, and so I think he's kind of really focusing on that. And there's now like a trade paperback line that Cemetery Dance is putting out, which I have a book on, as I mentioned, and that's doing really, really well. They're putting out a lot of amazing stuff. So I think that's kind of their new focus. And then, Thunderstorm and Earthling. And I'm doing another book, a deluxe limited edition that's going to be announced really any day. I can't announce it because the publisher has that. It's their thing. But it'll be released hopefully in December. But it's one of my novels, we'll call it that. It's not this one, we'll say that. it's going to come out. It's going to be a big, beautiful deluxe edition that's coming out at the end of the year. Yeah, so I'm super excited about that. My lips are sealed. I can't say. When authors say that, by the way, it sounds like you're being a jerk. It's because the publisher has
announced it.
It's their right to say. So you don't want to take that away from them. It's their product. And also some publishers don't want to announce stuff because they don't want readers to be, because if they have some sort of publishing issue, because these books are all to be signed, they all have slipcases, or a lot of them have slipcases or whatever. They're like beautifully constructed, and sometimes things can hold up. And so I think a lot of publishers get nervous about announcing something before they know, okay, we're definitely going to have it by this date. So that's why I think also they don't want to. Right, exactly right. Exactly right.
Well, Philip, it's been a treat having you. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Everybody watching online as well. Maybe we'll break up and have you sign some books for us.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. I really appreciate it. Thank you.